Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Brenda Davis. Brenda Davis is a registered dietitian, a respected researcher, and an internationally acclaimed speaker. She's a past chair of the Vegetarian Nutrition Dietetic Practice Group of the American Dietetic Association. Brenda is the co-author of 9 books, including Defeating Diabetes, Becoming Vegan, The Raw Food Revolution Diet, and Dairy-Free and Delicious. Her books are nutrition classics with more than 750,000 copies in print in 8 languages. As the lead dietitian in a diabetes intervention project in the Marshall Islands, her findings show that with support, healthy changes can take root in any community. So now, Brenda, my dad and I are so grateful for your brilliant work, and we're so glad to have this time with you. And for the interview, I'm going to hand it over now to my dad, John Robbins.
Thanks so much, Ocean. It's such a pleasure and a privilege to be with you.
Well, thank you, Brenda, for being with us once again. It's always a joy to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much, John.
You know, for a long time, animal protein has been considered superior, while plant-sourced proteins have been called incomplete. But with every passing year, that belief seems increasingly inaccurate and even misleading. I'm thinking of a recent study. It was published in JAMA Internal Medicine. Researchers followed the diets of more than 130,000 people, and they found that animal protein intake was associated with an increased risk for death from many diseases, while plant protein intake was associated with a lower risk for mortality. Brenda, what I want to ask you is, what's the take-home message about protein from this and many, many other studies for people who want to live a long and healthy life?
Yeah, I think the take-home message, John, is really simple. It's get your protein from plants as much as you possibly can. And the reason is, you know, plant foods, especially the protein-rich plant foods, provide a number of compounds that you're not going to get from meat. And so I'm thinking about fiber and phytochemicals and antioxidants and the pre and probiotics and all of these things, and they provide sufficient but not excessive protein. When we talk about, you know, plant protein foods, we're talking mainly about legumes and legume products like soy products. They don't have a lot of the sort of negative components that animal protein foods have. Meat, you've got, all kinds of compounds, Nu5GC, which is pro-inflammatory molecule in animal flesh. You've got heme iron, which is a pro-oxidant, carnitine that we know can be converted to trimethylamine oxide, which is a highly atherogenic compound. There's, you know, if you cook meat, most people cook meat at high temperatures, you're producing things like heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, advanced glycation end products, and all of these compounds that really are quite pro-inflammatory. And then, you know, of course, meat is very high on the food chain, so we're concentrating environmental contaminants as well. And then, of course, we know meat especially increases IGF-1 levels, which may increased risk of cancer. So there are a lot of factors, a lot of negatives on meat side and a lot of positives on plant food side. And that's why we're seeing the results we see in the literature.
And that's why we're seeing such heightened disease risk with from animal proteins. Well, in the past, some people believe one could really not get too much protein. We just wanted more of it oftentimes. And still today, we have diet books that encourage very high protein diets for weight loss. While people who follow these diets sometimes do have short-term success in losing weight, they're often unaware of the longer-term health risks.
Yeah.
So Brenda, how does somebody know if they're getting enough protein? And are there real risks from getting too much?
Well, such a good question. You know, so the first question, how does someone know if they're getting enough? Certainly, if you get enough calories and you're eating a good mix of plant foods, including some more concentrated protein sources like legumes, nuts and seeds, and so forth, it's actually hard not to get enough protein. There are really two ways that people blow it in terms of getting enough protein, and one is by not eating enough calories. So they may have an eating disorder or maybe sick or something like that, and in that case, they may not get enough. And the other is to eat mostly foods that are either free of protein or very low protein food. So if people are eating sort of junk food diets where they're eating a lot of sugar, drinking a lot of soda, eating a lot of deep fried foods like French fries, they may not get enough protein because these foods, you know, aren't significant sources. So those are the, you know, common ways that people would blow it. But people that are eating a mixed, plant-rich diet, they're not going to have difficulty getting enough protein. And then for the second part of the question, John, are there risks of getting too much protein? Well, actually, there are significant risks, and we've seen a number of studies that demonstrate that. In fact, there was an interesting study, from Harvard in 2016 that followed about 130,000 participants, and they found that replacing just 3% of your calories from animal protein with plant protein significantly reduced risk of death. So, and then we've got another study, the study that came out in 2014. Levine looked at people consuming over 20% of calories from protein, and what he found is that it was an issue for people if they were getting their protein from animal products, but not if they were getting their protein from plant products. And for people from 50 to 65 years of age, you know, we saw really huge increases in mortality, cancer deaths. Cancer deaths were four times higher for people that were getting, you know, over 20% of calories from protein. Diabetes was about four times higher.
Well, when we're saying that people experienced a reduced risk of death or with lower protein intakes, or a heightened risk of death with increased levels of protein intake, what everybody in the long run, the risk of death is 100%. But we're talking about in a given year. So what we're really talking about is longevity. We're talking exactly about the fact that their lives are cut shorter when they're eating too much protein, in particular, too much animal protein. Is that the truth?
Oh, absolutely. I did a search a few years back looking at all of the meta-analyses, and I've been following them ever since. And if you look at meta-analyses since 2012 right up to today, the research is so consistent. It's unbelievable. We just see over and over and over again probably 10 to 20% increased risk for unprocessed red meat and 20, 30% increased risk for processed red meat. And there was actually just a study put out in 2017.
Well, we're seeing this over and over again.
Yeah.
And when people want to eat plant-based proteins, very often they turn to soy and other legumes, but soy uniquely. And there is a widespread belief that it's unhealthy for men to eat tofu because the phytoestrogens in soy can perhaps lower testosterone and sperm counts. In fact, there's been a lot of controversy about soy foods in general. So, Brenda, what's the truth about soy foods, and what's the best way to eat soy, if there is, in fact, a best way?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not sure there's any single food that's been studied more than soy. There are just literally thousands of research articles on soy. And, you know, I would say if men want to eat soy, that they should eat soy, unless they're allergic to it, of course. There really is no significant clinical evidence that soy lowers testosterone or sperm count or causes any feminizing effects. There were two case studies that I know of in the literature that showed feminizing effects of soy in men. And in one of the guys, he was eating, I think, 13 or 14 servings a day. And in the other, the guy was eating 18 to 20 servings a day. So they were living, that's all they were eating, pretty much. And of course, that's a ridiculous amount. And so, you know, people that are eating soy in reasonable amounts, there aren't negative impacts. And, you know, I often tell people, do the acid test. And to me, the acid test is take a look at the longest lived people in the world and you know, what do they eat? And even within the blue zones, you look at five of the blue zones, two out of the five are consuming soy on a regular basis, the Okinawans and the Seventh-day Adventists. And they average about two servings a day. And I think if soy was as poisonous as some people make it out to be, I doubt it would be a major staple in the diet of some of the longest-lived people on the planet.
I don't think it would be. I do know that conventional soy, not organic, but conventionally grown soy today in the United States and Canada is mostly genetically engineered.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're going to eat soy products today, given that fact, this is one of those foods that you really should try to get organic if you possibly can.
I agree. Absolutely. So, you know, getting to that part of the question, what's the best way to eat it? I would say eat organic, eat less processed. And so that means things like edamame and tofu and tempeh and soy milk. So again, you know, stick to organic as much as possible.
Yes, for several reasons.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You mentioned nuts. We hear a lot about the health value of nuts. And the landmark PREDIMED study discovered some really remarkable things about nuts. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, the PREDIMED, for people that aren't really familiar with PREDIMED, PREDIMED was a large primary prevention trial that happened in Spain, and they followed almost 7,500 people for about 5 years, I think it was. We've had literally dozens of studies come out of the PREDIMED trial. But the one that I think is really interesting on specifically about nuts was a study from 2013 that looked at sort of people consuming the greatest amounts of nuts, and they looked at the nut consumption where they were at baseline, so the people that were already consuming nuts when they came into the study. And then they looked at sort of the group that were at the highest end of kind of the intake range, and they compared them to the people that weren't consuming nuts at all. And what they found is that they had about a 63% lower mortality risk, about a 55% lower risk of cardiovascular disease mortality, and a 40% lower risk of cancer mortality. So very, very strong findings. And we've known for years that there's a pretty strong connection between risk of heart disease and nut consumption. But they found some other very, you know, the interesting findings on overall mortality and cancer as well. And, you know, we've had others, the Adventist Health Study that showed almost 50% risk reduction for the highest nut consumers, and the Nurses' Health Study, the Physicians' Health Study. We've just, the Iowa Wounds Health Study, we've got a lot of studies that have shown benefits for, you know, for the highest nut consumers compared to the lowest nut consumers.
It would seem that nuts are an excellent way to get your fat in your diet.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm thinking about peanuts. They're not technically nuts, they're legumes, but they have many of the nutritional characteristics of nuts.
Yeah.
And most people think of them as nuts. I really have two questions for you, Brenda, about peanuts. First, are they as nutritious and health promoting as the other nuts? And second, and relatedly, do you recall what the Harvard researchers who conducted the famous Nurses' Health Study learned about peanut butter, heart attack risk, and fibrocystic breast disease?
Yeah, so the first question, are they, you know, as nutritious as other nuts? I would say simply yes. And as you said, they're not really tree nuts. They're actually legumes, but nutritionally, they really are a little more similar to tree nuts than most legumes. So they, you know, they have a little more protein than other nuts. They actually have better quality protein. And otherwise, they're reasonably similar. But they also are very rich sources of plant sterols and a phytochemical that many people have heard of called resveratrol, which we find in, you know, in grapes and grape juice and red wine and so forth. So there are a number of, you know, significant advantages to eating peanuts. The concerns about eating peanuts are related mainly to allergies, pesticides, and aflatoxins. And peanuts are often exposed to significant, as you know, pesticides. And so, of course, we have the easy way to try to avoid that, and that's by buying organic. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is we used to always tell people who were pregnant not eat peanuts so that the baby wouldn't be allergic. And we now know we need to do the exact opposite. It seems that if, you know, early consistent feeding of peanut butter to young children, in their later infancy, actually helps to prevent peanut allergies rather than increase them. And then the other part that we have to think about a little bit is the aflatoxins. And I think I myself don't stay away from peanuts because of aflatoxins, because I think the science is fairly clear, and the science is partially seen in that study that you mentioned, the Nurses' Health Study, that people who eat peanuts and peanut butter on a regular basis actually have some fairly significant health advantages, including, you know, reduced risk of cancer and heart attack. And but the studies that you mentioned, John, the fibrocystic breast disease, which is also called sometimes benign breast disease, there were a couple of studies that actually followed the daughters of the nurses from the Nurses' Health Study. And they found that women they had two studies, one in 2010 and one in 2013. And the one in 2010 found women consuming two or more servings of nuts, peanuts, or peanut butter per week had a 30% lower risk of fibrocystic breast disease. And in 2013, they found that women consuming the peanuts and peanut butter or beans daily, so this was not twice a week, but every day, starting at age 14, actually had a 66% risk reduction. So that's pretty impressive.
It is. It's really impressive. And you know, there are some advocates of plant-strong diets who encourage very, very low-fat consumption, which would mean minimizing foods like peanuts and other nuts and seeds and avocados.
Yeah.
But I see these as excellent foods that can play a healthy role in an optimal diet. What role do you see for nuts and seeds and avocados?
Well, I'm on the exact same page as you are. I agree that there's some very convincing, powerful evidence that the use of very low-fat, sort of plant-based diets like Dr. Esselstyn's and Dr. Ornish's diets are very powerful therapeutic treatment tools for people with severe coronary artery disease. But this does not mean that these kinds of diets should serve as the gold standard for people eating, you know, trying to eat a healthy plant-based diet. And we literally have hundreds of scientific studies that are showing that these high-fat plant foods not only deserve a place in the diet, but I think they deserve a place of honor. They're such valuable sources of healthy fats. There are critical sources of essential fatty acids for people eating plant foods. This is where we get our omega-3s and our omega-6s and so forth. They're really important sources of trace minerals, and like selenium from Brazil nuts and zinc and iron and so forth. And then the other thing is the vitamin E. So many people on low-fat diets have a difficult time getting sufficient vitamin E. They're great sources of folate. They're one of our richest sources of L-arginine, which gets converted to nitric oxide, which, as we know, is a pretty potent vasodilator. And then, of course, they provide a whole host of phytochemicals and antioxidants, and you know they're of all plant foods, they have the lowest glycemic impact. So they're fairly low in carbohydrate, and the glycemic load is very, very small for these foods. So they can actually help to reduce the sort of rate of absorption of sugars into the bloodstream. So it's just all good.
They actually lower the glycemic load of a meal that they're part
of. Exactly.
Are there any other nutrients that people eating plant-strong diets need to take special concern for? And what are some of the most common nutritional mistakes that are made by people who adopt a plant-strong or a vegetarian or a vegan type of diet?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple of mistakes at two ends of the spectrum. One is people switching from meat and potatoes to pasta and bagels. And you will never achieve any sort of optimal health by replacing meat with refined carbohydrate foods. And so we have to be very careful of that. Those foods are stripped of their nutritional value and often a bunch of garbage is added to make them even more palatable. So we need to be very careful of that. We want to replace meat and potatoes or whatever it is people are eating in a more omnivorous pattern with a variety of whole plant foods like legumes and vegetables and fruits and whole grains and nuts and seeds and so forth. So it's, just learning to do that can be a challenge for people. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we see the people that go on fairly radical extreme diets where the diet is really quite restrictive. It's just too restrictive. And so they're eliminating the nuts and seeds and avocados and all of these things. They're being really quite rigid with the amount they're eating and so forth. And so those people can get into trouble. So they're not eating anything that's fortified with vitamin B12, but they also have the attitude that I don't want to take supplements because I should be able to get what I need from whole foods. And so at that end of the spectrum, we can run into some problems as well. And extreme raw diets, for example, people can get very low on vitamin B12, vitamin D, even iodine. A lot of people don't want to use iodized salt, and they don't eat seaweed either. But the nutrients that we really do have to be most concerned about in a really good whole food plant-based diet are vitamin B12, vitamin D, and iodine, I would say. And vitamin B12 is a nutrient that just is not found in plant foods to any significant degree. I mean, you might get little bits in mushrooms. You might get little bits in tempeh if you make it in, if it's fermented in some dirty container. But generally, plant foods are not reliable sources of B12. So you need to rely on fortified foods or supplements. And
for B12.
Exactly, yeah.
You mentioned vitamin D. I want to talk about that a little bit.
Oh, sure.
In late 2010, the Institute of Medicine released its new guidelines for vitamin D, yeah, updating them from the previous, which I think was 1997. They don't do this very often.
No.
But the recommendations for vitamin D were modestly increased.
Right.
But I don't think nearly as much as the growing research in vitamin D warrants. To my eyes, establishing 20 nanograms per milliliter as the level that is needed for good bone health for practically all people, which is what they did, strikes me as not just inadequate, but possibly even malpractice. I'm thinking, for example, of a study that was published in the journal Gut recently. They analyzed data from two large studies of health professionals. They found that people with vitamin D blood levels around 20 nanograms per milliliter, which the Institute of Medicine says is great, had literally 10 times the risk of colon cancer compared to those people with higher vitamin D levels, in this case around 37 nanograms per milliliter. Now, the Vitamin D Council suggests that a level of 50 nanograms per milliliter is the ideal level to aim for. So, Brenda, what's your view of this controversy? Do you take a vitamin D supplement? And if so, how much do you take?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I do take a vitamin D supplement, and I take 1,000 IUs a day. I have many friends who take 2,000 or more. I think the amount you need depends on your exposure to sunshine, your age, your body weight. There are so many things that affect how much you need. But the best thing to do is to find out kind of where you're at. And I can't tell you how many vegetarian and, plant-based friends that I have that went and had their levels tested, and they were really shocked by the results, just shocked, like levels of 5 or 7 or, nanograms per mil. So it is a nutrient that we do need to be very conscious of. We need to make sure that we're including a very reliable source on a daily basis. If you have, sufficient warm sun exposure during whatever months you have that, you may be able to make enough, but not even necessarily. It's quite interesting. Studies that have been done in Hawaii and warm areas, the percentage of people that actually are vitamin D deficient is shocking. So it's one of those things that when you go to your doctor, it wouldn't be a bad idea to get it monitored and just see where you're at.
Well, we evolved as people who lived outside, outdoors, yeah, for the most part, and now we live lives indoors, yeah, for the most, yeah, part. So even if you're in Hawaii, you're probably indoors, possibly even in an air-conditioned space, at least most people are, most of the time. So given our modern lifestyles, it seems to me that vitamin D supplementation in some form,
yeah,
is really helpful.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
I want to ask you about another controversial topic in nutrition. We've been told for decades that the type of iron, heme iron, that's in red meat is the best source of iron for the human body. But it seems that that may very well not be true. In fact, the type of iron found in beef in particular, unlike the type of iron found in plants, can increase oxidation of LDL cholesterol. And that is not good, because if your LDL is highly oxidized, you'll have more plaque in your arteries.
Right.
Brenda, does this mean that beef, which has been advertised and has been promoted as the best source of iron, might actually be causing heart disease because of its iron content?
Yeah, I think the evidence is really, really strong that heme iron increases oxidative stress and increases our risk of heart disease and other diseases as well. And there was actually a meta-analysis done in 2014 looking at, I think it was over 20 studies, and a lot of participants with like very significant, at least a decade of follow-up. And they found that heme iron from meat increased risk of heart disease about 1.5 times, or about 150% plus. What we know really is that when you consume iron in the form of ferritin, which you might get from legumes, for example, it's this huge molecule with 1,000 atoms of, you know, I shouldn't say 1,000, thousands of atoms of iron. And it's absorbed, that molecule is absorbed into your bloodstream. And those molecules are released slowly, one by one, as your body kind of needs them. Whereas heme iron, it just races through the intestinal tract into the bloodstream. And there's no control. It's very rapidly absorbed, and it affects, it acts as a prooxidant, whereas non-heme iron does not act as a prooxidant. So we know without any shadow of a doubt that heme iron is an issue.
World health statistics show that osteoporosis is most common, ironically, in exactly those countries where dairy products are consumed in the highest quantities. I'm thinking the United States, Finland, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. In recent years, the evidence against dairy products has been growing. One study, a very large study, found that women who drink 2.5 or more glasses of milk a day have a much higher risk of fractures than their counterparts who drink less than a glass a day. Brenda, if dairy consumption isn't the best answer to preventing osteoporosis, what is, and what's the best way to ensure that we're getting enough calcium?
Yeah, and I'm not absolutely convinced that dairy itself is a causative factor for osteoporosis. I'm not, you know, it could be that people that consume a lot of dairy also consume a lot of meat and a lot of processed foods and a lot of salt and not enough potassium and not enough of the nutrients that are necessary for bone health. But to me, the important question really is, where should our calcium come from? We need calcium. What we need to really try to figure out is what foods make most sense as our calcium sources. And if you look back in Paleolithic times, you're looking at intakes of 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams a day without a single drop of any mammal milk. And where did it come from? It came from, you know, the greens and the vegetables and so on that people were consuming in those days. And we can get, you know, calcium from the same sources. We can get it from low oxalate greens. Things like spinach are not, even though they have a lot of calcium in them, we don't absorb the calcium from those foods very well because of the oxalic acid content. But low oxalate greens like kale and broccoli and turnip greens and so on. The Chinese greens are excellent calcium sources. Tofu, legumes, even things like almonds and tahini, and we get some calcium from figs and some fruits and vegetables. Those are really, really good sources. And then to boost our calcium intake to meet the RDA, we could have maybe one serving of fortified non-dairy milk, and we'd be there.
You mentioned Paleolithic times.
Yeah.
The Paleo period lasted about 2 million years, and it ended about 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture.
Yeah.
Once we began cultivating grains and legumes and domesticating animals for food, the human diet changed greatly. Prior to that, we kept no livestock, and almost everything we ate was wild. Now today, Paleolithic diets are the subject of many books and websites, and there's a lot of fervor about them. The idea that we might benefit from taking our ancestral diet into consideration when evaluating the foods on which our organs and cells and existence thrives, to me, makes good sense. But the diet our ancestors ate was high on wild plants and insects, which is a far cry from what is recommended today by most advocates of a so-called paleo diet.
Yeah.
Now, I know, Brenda, you've taken a really hard look at all this, and you've come to some remarkable conclusions. What are you seeing?
The evidence is pretty clear from a human health perspective that paleo, you know, what people are calling paleo-style diets are probably, if they're well-planned, they're probably preferable to Western diets because they're, you know, they get rid of the processed foods, they get rid of dairy. But the problem is that they're eating huge quantities of meat. They completely, you know, forget that Paleolithic ancestors also consumed probably somewhere 70 to 150 plus grams of fiber. Vegans, the average vegan gets maybe 40 or 50 or 60. fiber comes from plant foods. And so they were eating a truckload of plant food.
Well, if I'm hearing you correctly, then the average vegan today is actually getting a fiber intake level that's closer to what paleo people actually got than are the people eating paleo diets today. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And as a matter of fact, I have an analysis where I took 3 days of paleo menus off one of the most popular paleo websites on the internet and analyzed them and then compared those numbers with the best estimates we have for Paleolithic intakes. And then I did 3 days worth of vegan menus and analyzed those and compared the three. And what I found was that the paleo diet today was closer to the true Paleolithic diet in their protein intakes, in their zinc, and in their vitamin A. Vegan diets were closer in everything else. Carbohydrates, saturated fat, total fat, essential fatty acids, and almost all of the vitamin minerals. I think it was 12 or 13 nutrients that the vegan diet was closer on.
Well, I have thought that you mentioned vegans and paleo people and the current paleo diets and how we were talking about how they compare to the true paleo diet, what people ate in Paleolithic times. I think that today's vegans and today's paleo eaters have something to learn from each other. I think that today's paleo eaters could learn from vegans to eat a lot less meat, as you've been talking about, and they'd be healthier, as would our world, our planet, if they took that course. And I think that vegans could learn to eat less processed foods and to eat less flour and less sugar from paleo people.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that if we had a dialogue in which we were looking for the optimally healthy diet and weren't too set in our belief systems, we might be able to learn from each other more and actually become a more connected people.
I love that. That's wonderful because I know that the people who are doing paleo are wanting to achieve optimal health. That's why they've gotten rid of so many of the harmful foods.
I'd like to ask you about diabetes. This is a subject that you have real expertise in, your studies in the Marshall Islands. You've written books about it. in our society, the incidence of type 2 diabetes, it's rising to epidemic proportions, even in children. It used to be called adult onset diabetes because it just occurred only in adults, but now we're seeing it in kids. There's a study, a very highly regarded Seventh-day Adventist health study, and it found that the rates of type 2 diabetes were more than 50% lower for vegetarians. And in people who were aged 50 to 69, the difference was even greater. There was a stunning 76% less diabetes in vegetarians. So, Brenda, what accounts for this rather staggering advantage for vegetarians when it comes to type 2 diabetes? And what nutritional advice would you give to someone wanting to lower their risk for diabetes as much as they can?
Yeah, so it's really quite interesting to see. And what most people have thought was that the advantage for the vegetarians was basically that they were leaner and the fewer animal products they consumed. So vegans being the leanest and actually the only group in the Adventist healthy eating group categories that actually were within the healthy BMI range. But in fact, the numbers didn't change as much as they thought when they controlled for BMI. Even controlling for BMI, the vegans still had about a 62% lower risk, and the lacto-ovo-vegetarians probably about, I think it was 38%. But so definitely it's about more than just having a leaner body weight. And so there, you know, I would think it's most likely because plant foods are higher in fiber and phytochemicals and antioxidants, reduce inflammation. They help to foster a healthy gut flora, which is important for insulin resistance. So there are just all kinds of factors that kind of work synergistically to provide the kind of protection that we want to achieve. And, you know, we know that people that eat more fruits and vegetables have less diabetes. People that eat whole grains instead of refined grains have less diabetes. People that eat more nuts and seeds, all of these foods being quite protective. And so, you know, the absence of meat may be a fairly significant factor as well, because meat is really, especially processed meat, is really strongly linked with diabetes risk. I looked at all the, you know, meta-analyses done in the last 5 or 6 years, and processed meat up to 50% increase in risk, and unprocessed meat probably about 20-30% increase in risk. So it's really quite startling. So certainly I think people need to, you know, pay attention to that. And in terms of you know, what their diet should look like, really, to give them the sort of best chance of avoiding diabetes, and if they have diabetes, to have the best chance at reversing their disease. And it is a completely reversible disease for most people, unless their pancreas has been destroyed, which it can be over many years. But for people that are still producing insulin, this is a very treatable disease. And so what the diet needs to look like is, you know, at least half your plate at every meal needs to be fruits and vegetables, and a lot of green leafy vegetables. I would say legumes in one form or another at least 2 or 3 times a day. Nuts and seeds and you know, these higher fat whole plant foods being your primary sources of fat instead of the oils, which provide very little, few nutrients, but a lot of calories. And then you want to make sure, one of the most important things I like to tell people is where grains are concerned. There, you know, a lot of people think I'm eating whole grains, I'm eating whole wheat bread, I'm eating, you know, puffed wheat. They're, you know, they pick whole grains that are fairly highly processed. And there really is, where whole grains are concerned, a hierarchy. In terms of the whole grain hierarchy, at the top of the hierarchy are intact whole grains. So that they're grains as you would pick them off the plant. There's nothing added. There's nothing taken away. You haven't messed with them. You're getting everything nature intended. And these are foods that have a very low glycemic impact. So the next on the, you know, on sort of the hierarchy would be the cut grains, like steel cut oats. Then you would have the rolled grains. Then you would have shredded grains. Then you would have ground grains, where I'm talking about whole grain flours. Then you would have flaked grains, and at the bottom of the barrel, you've got puffed grains. And as you go down that hierarchy, you're progressively losing nutritional value and increasing glycemic impact. Whenever you increase the surface area of a food, you increase the rate of its absorption. So we want to be sticking, especially if you have diabetes, at the top of that hierarchy to help reduce the glycemic load of the food you're eating.
That's actually why I was thinking that one of the things vegans could learn from paleo eaters is to eat less flour.
Absolutely.
You know, Brenda, I've had the great pleasure, really, of being your friend and colleague for many years, and it's always wonderful to speak with you personally and professionally. I appreciate in particular how thorough and thoughtful you are, how informed and also wise you are and caring. You are one of our gems, one of our treasures. On behalf of myself and of Ocean and of everyone involved in the Food Revolution Network, I thank you for being with us today and for your ongoing efforts to help as many people as you can to have the wonderful benefits of a healthy life.
Well, John, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate the invitation and appreciate our friendship. For so many years, I have learned so much from you, and I just hold you up as one of the great heroes, you and your son Ocean, both as heroes of this world. And I'm very, very grateful for the work you're doing. Thank you so much.
We've been talking with registered dietitian Brenda Davis, co-author of 9 award-winning books, including Becoming Vegan, and one of the leading experts on how you can thrive on a plant-powered diet. Brenda, your insights are seasoned. They are born out of decades of experience. They're up to the minute, learning from the latest insights and breaking news, and they're deeply compelling. You are providing hope and health to so many people. And we want to thank you for your time, for your wisdom, for your leadership, for your vision, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much, Ocean. It was very much a privilege.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.